Welcome to episode 422 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we have an exhilarating conversation with Black working class human rights organizer and strategist, co-founder of Put People First PA, Nijmi Zarinko. And we discuss with Nijmi poverty, the recently introduced third Reconstruction resolution. We discuss many of the related ills and challenges we face in society that are connected with poverty. Very insightful, moving, informative conversation on this week's program with Nijmi Zarinko. We have an EW essay titled Wawa, and we share two readings, an excerpt from an article written by the great W.E.B. Du Bois in 1897 for the Atlantic magazine titled Strivings of the Negro People, and we have a piece written for the February 2021 edition of the Sun magazine's Reader's Right section by Carrie Lee Daniel. And we also have a poem called Pineapple Socks. And of course, all of this will be imbued, infused with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 422 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
Just to let you drop, we got started.
Wawa. The poverty-stricken in my town don't make a sound. They move around the main streets, alleyways, and through the underbrush, no rush. Some have a place to rest that is home. Many more are on an everlasting roam toward a solution. Is poverty the same as being poor? Either way, society is likely to demur at the prospect of truly helping. You and I know the amount of wealth in this world, the truckloads of food that are left to rot instead of being distributed to those of us who have not yet found a way today to purchase enough of the good stuff for healthy living. A student recently told me about an idea he had come to him while working at a Wawa in Philadelphia. He noticed every day there would be thrown away dozens of breakfast sandwiches that hadn't been bought and eaten. He proposed to his manager the notion of taking those sandwiches to a nearby shelter for hungry people to consume. His energy and vision were thwarted by thoughts steeped in economics and inefficient use of time. So jejune. And so the story goes. Despite all of our romantic poetry and thought-provoking prose, we continue to not see how to solve the problem of human inequality and indifference. As we remain complicit with concomitant actions of implicit judgment, shame, and blame. And thus we simply dismiss it, a natural part of life, like the winter wind blowing around debris and a soothing summer rain falling on us for free.
Glad I pulled the reins on this thing when I did. I see no reason to go ahead with it. In your eyes I see the weight of the planet, and it's sucking me out. Your stone looks hot as it starts to roll. We shared a meal and then you had to go. I've been over that night in my head, and you were psyching me out. Try and look for you if I'd know that you've arrived. In your eyes I see the weight of the planets you lost, and it's sucking in.
Nijmi Zarinko, is that you?
It's me.
All right. Black working class human rights organizer and strategist, co-founder of Put People First PA, among other things, Nijmi Zarinko, once again on the program, second time around. And you're just coming back from an exciting trip, I understand, talking about. Today, we're going to talk a bit about, I think, some of that stuff that you witnessed, in particular, a resolution put before Congress, right? Third Reconstruction, as it were. But first, how's it going? We haven't spoken since, I think, around Thanksgiving 2020. Everything good?
Yeah, thank you for having me back. I'm doing well. I'm very grateful. And I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to have you. I know the crux of what we're going to discuss today has to do with poverty. And do you want to give us a little insight as to what I referenced regarding that resolution put before Congress?
Sure, absolutely. So I believe that before we did speak on the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. I've been involved in the build-up to the new Poor People's Campaign. It was originally the last campaign that MLK did at the end of his life before he was assassinated in 1968. We revived the campaign. We reignited the campaign in 2018 after about 10 years of work and preparation for that. We reignited the campaign on the 50th anniversary of the original campaign. And really, the Poor People's Campaign is addressing four interconnected evils of systemic racism, poverty, ecological devastation, and militarism. And we relaunched in 2018, and it's been about three years now. And we've reached a very exciting milestone after organizing in over 40 states for the last 3 years, really statewide efforts, which are an incredible scale of the campaign right now. We've really built power from the bottom up, not relying on partisanship, not focusing on the left or the right, but really focusing on building and developing leaders among the 140 million people in this country who are poor or near poor. And yesterday we announced the introduction of a resolution in Congress, a resolution to end poverty. And that was announced yesterday, very, very exciting, with the Progressive Caucus in the House. And we're going to be lifting that up with actions across the country on June 7th to pressure members of Congress to sign on to this resolution.
Yeah, it's being touted as something akin to the Green New Deal, as it would affect environmental issues. Right? I mean, it's a big framework.
It's a very big framework, correct. It's a very big framework. And I think it's really attempting to be a reframe, right? A very significant reframe of a number of ways that we've come to see issues, one as being separate, right? I think the Poor People's Campaign has been excellent at helping us understand that these are not all separate issues. They're interconnected. You can't talk about environmental justice without talking about systemic racism, without talking about poverty. They're inseparably connected. You can't talk about mass incarceration without talking about racism, poverty, environmental devastation, militarism, right? They're all interconnected. So I think there's a reframe around interconnecting these issues and dealing with them as a whole agenda, not as just pieces, but as actually an agenda of the poor and dispossessed, the working class in this country. And I think there's a reframe, or also very importantly, around who is poor and how we understand poverty. When we have a poverty measure that's based on a very outdated metric, and it's never been updated, and that severely undercounts what the reality is of this country, which is that 140 million people, or you know, nearly 50% of the population, are living at or below 200% of the federal poverty line. We need to update that poverty measure. So I think it's a really significant reframe around that, because we need to understand poverty as a structural problem of this economy and not as something that is attributable to individual behaviors, mistakes, pathologies, accidents, or ordained by God.
Right, right. And I think you make a couple of really profound and important connections regarding the general injustice and inequality that exists in our country and throughout the world, really. And one of the things that I always find interesting is people who consider themselves spiritual, you know, and are very connected to through, you know, a church or some other organized form of religion, a synagogue, a mosque, what is goodness. But still, oftentimes, not all, of course, but too many, in my view, of those folks would look at poverty in the way that you just referenced, you know, as an individual choice, almost, you know, people not maybe pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, so to speak, or what have you. How do you, and I know you're kind of, your organization is somewhat affiliated with spirituality too, from my understanding. Dr. King certainly was. How do you sort of reconcile yourself with that contradiction among people?
Well, I think that the contradiction, thank you for asking that question. I think the contradiction is the fact that we have the distorted moral narrative of Christian nationalism, right? I mean, this is the other piece. I'm glad you brought that up, because this is the other narrative that holds this system in place, and that we're also shifting and also really taking aim at, is the co-optation of religion by the class that rules and the state that works on its behalf. I mean, that's really what we have. I mean, if we look and we understand religion and we think about spiritual texts, religious texts, and traditions, you know, we've done a tremendous amount to really uncover, unearth, and reframe that the Christian tradition is, you know, the Bible talks about poverty and the poor so many times, and in always ways in which the poor are identified with. The poor are actually holy. The poor are revered and appreciated and not reviled. And so it's really more, the contradiction is more about the co-optation of religion by the ruling class and by the state, which is common to all eras, right? Wielding this weapon, wielding religion as a weapon. That is actually, you know, the slaveholders had a Bible. They had the slave Bible, right? Mm-hmm. And the slave Bible taught the slaves to be subservient to their masters. But that's not what religion, that's not what the Bible teaches, right? And right. So we, have done, you know, that is a core part of our work as well, is to shift the distorted moral narrative, because that moral narrative is a weapon against the poor, the distorted moral narrative. And we, but we need to unearth and show how that's a process that's happened for the sake of power, for the sake of maintaining the status quo, for the sake of oppressing and exploiting poor people. And it's not based actually in our religious traditions and our spiritual traditions. It's just based on the powerful using those traditions against us. So we have reclaimed those traditions in our interests.
Great. I appreciate that explanation. And, you know, I'm looking at the name of this this resolution, you know, Third Reconstruction. And I guess it has a reference to two previous reconstructions, right? Is that right? Am I understanding that correctly? If this is the third...
Yeah, that's the reference. Yeah, that's the implication. Yes.
What are the other two?
Well, the other two in this formulation are the first reconstruction after the end of the Civil War, when the period of actually formerly enslaved people and poor whites actually came together across the South, created new state constitutions. There were more black elected officials, you know, in the South in the period after Reconstruction than there were recently, you know, than there are today. I mean, that was a very profound period of history that's often overlooked. It was destroyed, you know, those efforts were destroyed through the Redeemer movement that kind of took back power for the elites in the South. But the period of Reconstruction is a very profound period that everyone should really understand and study, as well as the abolition of slavery, that movement. The second Reconstruction that's referred to is, you know, the Civil Rights Movement, which is very different in nature, from the first Reconstruction, but is here sort of being named as a second Reconstruction, and then this as a third Reconstruction, which I think, to my mind, is more in line with the first Reconstruction, which is actually to change the relationship of people to the economy and change the relationship of the majority of people to the predominant form of capital, which is what happened in the first Reconstruction. So I think we're going for something more like that in the third Reconstruction.
And in the context of that pursuit, I know I'm pretty certain you are somewhat of a socialist. I might be wrong, and I'm sure you'll correct me if I am. How do you feel about capitalism? I know you think it's an evil. Should we accept the fact that we are a capitalistic society, or should we change it? You know, are we looking to get everybody a fair shake at the, I guess, the fruits of the capitalistic society, or should we just change it into a more socialist, communist sort of approach?
I think we need to start by deeply understanding the nature of the system that we currently live in. I think this is a real mistake of many organizing efforts, is that they don't dive in and try to deeply understand actually political economy. There's kind of an assumption like, oh, we all know what it is because we live in it and, you know, we get it, but they don't, you know, but folks don't necessarily really study it or understand the nature of capitalism as a system and of political economy, and also not that it's not a static, unchanging system. It's also a system that goes through crisis. It's a system that has had different periods of different predominant forms of capital over time. So there's a lot there, and I think partly because economics and things are, you know, scary, our educational system is not one that really prepares us to think about these things, and we really get hurt a lot through the process of formal education. I think a lot of people just would prefer to avoid it, but I think we do have to be disciplined about really understanding it. I think through that understanding comes the realization that, you know, again, as we're saying, talking about this reframe, right, that poverty is produced by the system. If you think that poverty is an anomaly, and you think that poverty is just a kind of an outlying function or just something that happens by accident and it's not really a feature of capitalism, or if you think that systemic racism is not a feature of capitalism, or that militarism isn't a feature, right, or environmental devastation isn't a feature of capitalism but just sort of an accident, then you have a different understanding. But that this is why we have to, you know, struggle and strive to really understand the nature of the system that we live in. I mean, my primary focus is on thinking about and building toward and learning from history, how do we actually build human systems that meet human needs? It's not really as much about the labels, but it is about how we structure society and structure the economy to meet human needs. And also, what do we have at our disposal to do that right now that we maybe haven't had before in human history? And what can we learn from past processes of real societal change? And what can we learn also from other places in the world who, despite very difficult circumstances living in a global capitalist system, are actually trying to create and structure societies to meet human needs? So there's a whole lot, actually, to really learn and to explore. And that's the kind of work that I'm doing in collectivity with others, in the University of the Poor in particular, in organizations across the country that are connected to that effort, that I think that everyone really needs to be doing, because this is a very serious time period, and there's possibilities, you know, for real transformational change, but we can't do it if we're being outsmarted at every turn by the class that's in power, which of course wants to maintain their power.
Of course. And I appreciate the explanation and the insight. We're talking to Nijmi Zarenko, Black working class human rights organizer and strategist, among other things. And, you know, I mean, it's philosophical. When you're talking about capitalism, you're talking about socialism, communism, whatever ism, it's an economic philosophy, and it's also a sociological, I suppose, philosophy too. They go hand in hand. You're right, we shouldn't get caught. I would agree with you that we shouldn't get caught up in syntax and start arguing over definitions. Then we get our eyes distracted from the prize of justice and inequality. Though, you know, it seems to me people can't get past that, you know, in our society. We've seen it over the last 4 years in stark relief, given the very caustic president we had for those years, and then the Republican Party. That must be difficult, you know, that mentality, that stubbornness, so to speak, lack of desire to really talk. It must be very difficult to get anywhere if facing that sort of mentality.
I think in terms of organizing on the ground, you know, I think our experience is that actually majority of people are very open. The majority of people are, especially people who are impacted, and we know, I appreciate very much the intervention of the Poor People's Campaign. One of the biggest, most powerful interventions that they've made is to talk about the 140 million and break that down, not only in terms of percentages of different groupings, but also raw numbers. Because again, we are often the images and the focus of the mainstream media and many institutions really obscures the true nature of who all is really impacted in society. And so, you know, understanding both the disproportionality and the raw numbers of that 140 million is so important. And so when we are among the folks in that 140 million, no matter who they are, what their background is, we generally find that folks are hurting, that there's a lot of desire to try to find out how to solve problems of housing, healthcare, food, you know, debt, criminalization, and other, you know, wages, other forms of exploitation that people are very directly upset and affected by these problems, that they really want to try to figure out how to actually fix these problems, that a lot of folks don't have a lot of faith in the current system as expressed through the political system to solve these problems.
Exactly.
And so they're, you know, they're completely organizable if we just do the organizing work and not sort of fall into the traps that have been set for us, because we know that people are susceptible to, again, the media system, which is huge and certainly divides people along racial lines, divides people along party lines. And as long as we don't reinforce those divides by knocking doors and just sort of thinking that our goal is to turn people into Democrats, right? Like, that's basically, that's a losing proposition. But if your goal is to bring people into a movement and to unite with them on the basis of the places that they're hurting and the places that they want to solve problems and provide a space to help people think about how do we actually organize and fight back and solve those problems collectively, then you can do anything. But if you fall into those other divides and you just kind of act like you're an ambassador for, you know, what is already existing, then that doesn't work, I find. So I think it's to your point, we have had a great deal of success connecting with people, even in a highly charged, difficult environment where there's every effort being made to pit people against each other and divide people on the basis of political party, on the basis of race, on the basis of geography, on the basis of identity, sexuality, gender, all of that stuff. It's still very possible to bring people together, but you have to bring them together on the terms that actually work for our class and not the terms that are given to us by the ruling class.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And you're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest. And, you know, I think trust is a big part of it and lack thereof. Even though the system is broken, and I think a lot of people would agree with that, I look at numbers, voter turnout often, not in the presidential election as of late, but just locally we had an election, primary election. I mean, you did as well, I'm sure, where you're at. Our voter turnout in our city was abysmal. You know, a good person won, in my estimation, for mayor, but the number of people that went out to vote was almost embarrassing. And that speaks volumes to me. That's saying people just don't think it matters, you know, or the system is corrupt. It doesn't take care of them. And you can't make these, I believe, you can't make these grand changes that the Third Reconstruction Resolution and other sorts of challenges, that bills that might come up to face the challenges that we have. They can't be done unless we do it on a national level through a national government, in my opinion. I mean, grassroots builds it up and gets the right people in place and makes sure they're focusing on what is necessary and they're doing it right, for sure. But you can't coordinate unless it's done at a national level through the system that is our government, I think. Or do you think otherwise?
I very much agree that we need very broad, you know, nationwide interventions. Yes, like 100% agree with you. This isn't something that, when we're talking about really meeting human needs, like, yes, absolutely, there are, you know, local, regional things that can be put in place. But in terms of really changing some of the structures that govern society, yes, we need interventions at the national level. And we need to also understand that part of living in capitalism means that our politics, our laws, our courts, are all set up to defend the rights of capital. And so, you know, this is why we need a mass movement that certainly does participate politically and pressure politically, but understand that this is a struggle that goes beyond simply elections. And, you know, the Poor People's Campaign has been, I think, very, very wise in understanding that political participation is very important and that we need to be organizing ourselves around an agenda that works for us, not around a person, not around a political figure, not around a political savior, or around a cult of personality, or the lesser of two evils, but around an agenda that then, you know, we use to move people who are in office and also to move ourselves into political participation. Because when someone is really engaged in an ongoing way in an organization, then the question of voting is almost like second nature, right? It's like, oh yeah, voting is the least that somebody can do. It's like the simplest task. But if someone isn't already engaged in an organization, that's a different ballgame. So our challenge is not just to get people to vote, it's to get people into organizations.
Grassroots organizations, nonprofit organizations, you know, NGOs, all that kind of stuff?
I would say, yeah. I mean, I would say grassroots organizations that are really committed and centered around the kind of constituencies that we're talking about in the Poor People's Campaign, that grassroots organizations that are doing base building, that are built by members, that are actually uniting the class across lines of division, that are building leaders. There are an increasing number of organizations that have been doing this kind of organizing and are building it, you know, even building new projects, new organizing, you know, through the Poor People's Campaign. And if we are talking about something that isn't necessarily traditional community organizing. It's not traditional trade union organizing. It's really more rooted in, say, the examples of the National Union of the Homeless in the 80s, the way that they organized, the National Welfare Rights Union organizing, and the real organizing of the poor and dispossessed by the poor and dispossessed, those examples from history, which are a little bit different than sort of other traditional community organizing, but they're very important right now in this period that we're facing.
And do you see yourself running for political office at some point to try to change things from inside the system, or do you like it where you are at present?
Absolutely not. No, I have absolutely no intentions of ever running for office. And if I ever do, I hope someone comes and just smacks me in the face.
Why is that?
I mean, if you haven't gotten the gist by now, I don't, you know, I think that has its place, and I think that's a site of struggle that can be important as part of a larger process, but it's certainly not my focus or, you know, I don't believe we're going to be able to vote our way to a transformed society. I don't believe that that's going to happen simply through getting new and better people into the structures that exist, because, you know, that is, I don't really see that. I don't see any evidence bearing that out from my study, from my understanding. Now, of course, I'm not all-knowing. I don't know everything. I'm a student, of course, but based on my understanding thus far, I don't have faith in the concept of we just need to get better people into office, and that is going to be, you know, that's going to be the way. There's nothing that happens without mass movements, absolutely nothing. Mass movements are the engine that changes politics, and it doesn't, you know, that can change who's in office, and it can change how people take on stances in office wherever they're coming from, right? It's people that move that are the motor and the engine behind that. So I'm much more interested in building, identifying, developing, and uniting leaders of organizations and within organizations across the country.
Nijmi Zirinko, it's always a pleasure talking with you, and I will certainly be reaching out to you again to be on the program. Thank you for taking time out to talk with me and us.
Thank you, Lawrence. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for talking to me and for all the work that you do.
Oh, my honor and pleasure. And it's not nearly as much work as you do. Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Si, do, re, do, si, do, do, la, do, re, mi, re, do, si, la, sol, si, la. Si, si, hipócrita ya, cuenta las cosas atrás. Tú y tú debes de aprender, tú y tú de mí cada cual. Si es así, comprende que sí.
And now, two readings. One, an excerpt from an article written for The Atlantic magazine back in 1897 by the great W.E.B. Du Bois. And the other is from Reader's Write out of The Sun magazine's February 2021 issue. First, the piece by W.E.B. Du Bois. This is titled, Strivings of the Negro People. Between me and the other world, there is an unasked question, unasked by some through feelings of delicacy, by others through the difficulty of rightly framing it. All, nevertheless, flutter around it. They approach me in a half-hesitant sort of way, eye me curiously or compassionately, and then, instead of saying directly, "How does it feel to be a problem?" they say, "I know an excellent colored man in my town," or "I fought at Mechanicsville," or "Do not these southern outrages make your blood boil?" At these, I smile, or am interested, or reduce the boiling to a simmer, as the occasion might require. The real question, "How does it feel to be a problem?" I answer seldom a word. And yet, being a problem is a strange experience, peculiar even for one who has never been anything else, save perhaps in babyhood and in Europe. It is in the early days of rollicking boyhood that the revelation first burst upon me, all in a day, as it were. I remember well when the shadow swept across me. I was a little thing, away up in the hills of New England, where the dark Housatonic winds between Hoosac and Taconic to the sea, in a wee wooden schoolhouse. Something put it into the boys' and girls' heads to buy gorgeous visiting cards, 10 sets a package, and exchange. The exchange was merry, till one girl, a tall newcomer, refused my card, refused it peremptorily, with a glance. Then it dawned upon me with a certain suddenness that I was different from the others, or like, mayhap, in heart and life and longing, but shut out from their world by a vast veil. I had thereafter no desire to tear down that veil, to creep through. I held all beyond it in common contempt, and lived above it in a region of blue sky and great wandering shadows. The sky was bluest when I could beat my mates at examination time, or beat them at a foot race, or even beat their stringy heads. Alas, with the years, all this fine contempt began to fade, for the world I longed for and all its dazzling opportunities were theirs, not mine. But they should not keep these prizes, I said. Some, all, I would wrest from them. Just how I would do it, I could never decide. By reading law, by healing the sick, by telling the wonderful tales that swam in my head, some way. And now a reading of a piece written by Carrie Lee Daniel of Asheville, North Carolina. In 1990, I was laid off for the first time in more than 20 years of working. The U.S. economy was in a downturn, and my company had lost many of its contracts. My partner and I were also days away from closing on our first home. We considered calling the mortgage company to pull out of the sale, but we were too excited, and I was certain I can get another job. So we went through with it. Within a week of moving, I was hired at a consulting firm. The salary was better than at my last job. I had a great boss, and my coworkers were fun and creative. It didn't take long before our dream home became a money pit. The roof needed to be replaced, the dryer stopped working, and the stove died. All of this quickly ate up our savings. A few months later, I arrived at my office to find that federal authorities had shut down the entire operation overnight. The owner was charged with racketeering, and we were all out of a job. Of course, the mortgage payment was still due, so I applied for a position at a credit union. I had everything they required, except a college degree. So I doctored my resume, adding a 4-year degree from a college I attended for only 1 year. I was sure they would never check to see if it was real. The college didn't even exist anymore. I was hired, and for a few months everything was fine. Then my boss got a call from a friend whose daughter had just graduated. She was looking for a job, and the only way the credit union could hire her was if they let someone go. My boss rechecked my resume and discovered that I'd lied about my degree. I had never been as ashamed as I was the day my boss confronted me. She gave me a choice, resign or be fired. I resigned. That year I lost 3 jobs, my self-respect, and ultimately that relationship, all because I couldn't wait until the time was right to buy a home.
could be an honest.
We could
look the other way. Pretend we don't have problems. But how should I let you go?
Pineapple socks. My big toe protrudes the blue sock with pineapples. I try to shift the sock around, but over and over again it is found that big toe pokes through the hole and makes me think about how to get the tools together and work to mend. Can you comprehend?
What?
have it, episode 422 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Nijmi Zarenko. I'd also like to thank The Atlantic Magazine, W.E.B. Du Bois, Carrie Lee Daniel, The Sun Magazine, and these musical artists: Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Middle Kids, Aldous Harding, Roberto Roena, Madison McFerrin, Patty Griffin, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard II. And, of course, I would like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care.